Hello, this is Melissa. It is Real History. Today is the 25th of July, 2024, and I'm happy today to be speaking with Andrea. Andrea is in South Africa. She may want to tell us a little bit more about that. This is Darren's wife. I've had, I think so far, three Real Histories with Darren. And Darren has been helping me with Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope book club. And Andrea and Darren really are the ones who administer and keep the whole Telegram book club going, I think. And Andrea does amazing graphics. She is an artist. And so she's helped me quite a bit with the book club graphics. Anytime I'm announcing an upcoming chat or using that, those visuals announcing that have been made by Andrea. And lots of other things. But before I carry on, I'll just bring you on. Hello.
Hello, Melissa. Thank you so much for the opportunity to have a chat. I appreciate it. Yes, so as you mentioned, I'm quite active on Telegram. I have my own group, South Africa Unite, and which is more focused on Africa and the Africa Agenda 2064, which is different to Agenda 21, but a lot of it coheres. Recently, I have been looking into Alan Watt and started the Cutting Through Matrix channel. And as you know, from there, we started the book club. I guess the rest is history. But yes, Darren is also quite active, especially within the book club. But he's been helping me with the other channels, not as much these days, but certainly he's had a huge impact on Telegram users and helping folks get to the bottom of what reality actually is. That makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. This is what I notice. You see it particularly in social media, but it's everywhere, is that people start to get an understanding that something isn't right. And that's the point where they're most in danger, because many, many possibilities are presented.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, we are in our society, we have kind of lost the ability to perceive reality. And this is actually one of the things I'd like to talk about, which is our ability to see the truth. And coming at it from a completely artistic point of view, or from a visual point of view, if, say, for example, we are drawing a figure, and I often find that, say, my head is too small, and my teacher will say, your head is too small, you've drawn it too small, I then have to assess, what am I looking at, and also, is this truly the reality that I see in front of me? Or am I just drawing what I think I see? I often find that people who draw, or people who are quite, I would say, right brain focused, are more aware of what's happening in the world today. The other day we were in class and one of the students was speaking to the teacher, saying, you know, since I started drawing, I can't walk into a room without being aware of what I see. And I assess the whole time, is this shape, how would I draw that? Is that ear bigger than the nose? You know, so it's in a way a form of metacognition and in a way of using our senses to perceive reality. But more than that, actually, once you've drawn something and you realize that you were wrong, you have to let go of your ego and say, well, oops, you know, let me redraw that. So it is a perpetual correction of perception, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Alan did talk about this, how we have to be able to use all of our senses. And yeah. There's a section in his Cutting Through books where he goes into this, that we think of language as what is spoken or written or drawn, if it's pictographic. But it's a better way of thinking about language is it is a form of communication. And to really understand it, you've got to be engaged with at least several senses.
Yes, and interesting you mention that, because one of the things I would like us to look at as well is the work from William Blake. Now, first of all, before we go into that, I just want to mention off the bat, because we touched on this topic a bit in the book club, and I just want to lay down a little bit of a definition for art. Even though I know there are various forms of art, we've got movement, you know, we've got choreography, we've got drama, we've got dance, we've got all these different forms, but I'm specifically talking about the visual arts. And we all like certain things, and someone told me, and I had an argument with a lecturer, and they told me, it was actually a lecturer at Slade, and they told me, no, you know, Andrea, I want you to go and write down what you deem is art and the elements that you see art should contain, whether that be color, composition, or maybe topic. You know, if it should contain a life drawing, or it should contain portraiture, or it should be abstract, whatever it is, those elements are what you personally will look for when you look at something that you like. And it doesn't mean that if, say, another person deems abstract art more important than realism, that that's necessarily wrong, because it's in the eye of the beholder. But with that said, and if we look at H.G. Wells, A Shape of Things to Come, we look at all these novels, Man and the Machine, there's also art being used to steer culture and steer society. One of the things that you've mentioned just now is the senses, because William Blake has created these characters. One of the characters is called Urizen, but it's actually referring to your reason. And in your reason, I'm going to read this, if that's okay, because I'm not so familiar with his work, but it is quite important, because as said earlier, we are perceiving and seeing reality through our senses, right? So he's saying here, you will see, if you look at what your reason looks like, he's basically the creator, and he's got a compass in his hand, and he's pointing to the dark. I don't know if you could see that image. So he's based on the creator, but he's not the creator. It's just the characteristic of creating. According to Blake, he was the antagonist. He was quite evil. The compass in his hand is referring to measuring the ratio, which is more referring to reason, and reason coming from a materialistic point of view, taking over from the creative point of view. Let me just read some bits here. What does it say? Okay, so, because it's all accommodated with poems. So the poem itself is a somber satire of Milton's account of the creation. According to Blake, the 7 days of creation represent 7 phases of the imprisonment and binding of the caverned man within the limitations of a world experienced only through the 5 senses. And this is actually where they are going towards. They want to limit us only to the 5 senses, because there are more senses than that. Urizen, thus limited, becomes the self-deluded and anxious demiurge engaged in the enormous labors of imposing his ratio of the 5 senses on rebellious life whose nature he has not understood. Such, according to Blake, is human reason, the false god of the Enlightenment, and in France of Rousseau and Voltaire. So he's actually, because Blake was quite against establishment, he was quite against Because just to also say, there's nothing wrong with reason. There's nothing wrong with mathematics or with the left brain. But we are going towards a society where art and the right brain is being taken out of the equation. Because if you look at in the UK itself, they are cutting the budget for arts, and it is unwarranted. So you would have the arts education facing massive cuts. In 2021, Boris Johnson was, he was hailing art as being, you know, what makes the country great. But at the same time, they cut the budget with 50%. This obviously led to like an uproar within the art community, because these adverts came out in 2020, like you had Fatima's next job would be in cyber. So they are moving away from the right brain, from the imagination, from being creative, from using the senses and the visual towards more towards metaverse and technology and towards the reasoning part of the brain.
It's okay. I know that you're a rational and reasonable human being. I've talked to you enough times to know that. But it is perfectly all right to defend the other senses and imagination, because it's clear they're doing the same thing in the U.S. and everything is STEM, 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 science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Exactly. Papers actually show that when you have art within schools, that it literally creates empathy, it creates compassion, it helps children to see and place themselves within an art piece and see as another might have suffered, or it's very good for getting in touch with empathy in particular. And also in objective thinking.
You've sent some PDFs to go along with it, which I can use in the video. And you've just taken us to the first page of the first PDF. Do you want to go through that?
Yeah, so basically what they have found is that when they have, and here's another thing, the notion that they need to cut budget because it's too expensive is actually not true. It's not that expensive to have art within schools. It's not a large budget that it would take up if, say, in comparison to getting computers and having metaverse and so on. But what art and music and the arts does, and research has shown, that it enhances self-expression. And in particular, it is fostering individuality within children. And it's that bit that Alan Watt was also touching on, is the individual, you know, because it's moving away, not necessarily from collective thinking, and there's nothing wrong in collective thinking, but it's getting to know thyself, you know, and it's providing children to be more well-rounded, you know, and have, of course, empathy for others, you know, emotional intelligence. So it's a better way of understanding and also perceiving reality eventually in the end. With that said, I'm not surprised that they are moving towards taking it away from schools and moving more towards scientism. Also, if you look at Baha'i faith, eventually the religion that they want to unite all religions with, it's more scientific and it's got more of a scientific approach. If that's
interesting,
making sense, yeah. If we look at William Blake, he has, in a way, and I mean this book about your reason, is actually, in it, it states it's the first book, but there is no second book found. So I don't know if maybe he did make a second book, but it isn't been published. Yeah, he's basically rebelling against this creation and this creator, which I think he saw as coming from the views of Newton, coming from the views of Francis Bacon. He was rebelling against where they were only focused on reason and the laws of nature, materialism and scientism. And his counter to that was more imagination, and not necessarily, I mean, you could say imagination, but also consciousness. Yeah, William Blake, you know, if you think of, oh gosh, I'd forgotten, Hannibal, Hector Hannibal, where he had that image of the devil with the wings. I haven't included it in here. So just a little bit of history about William Blake. So he was born in England in 1757 and he died in 1827. He was a poet, a painter. He was a printmaker. Within printmaking, he had quite an impact on bringing in new techniques, which is using a copper plate with gum. A controversial figure at the time, many actually deemed him as being a bit of a crazy guy. Even still, he's got a stigma of being a bit of a loony. But his printmaking method, according to him, he got by communicating with his dead brother. So these are things that make it quite controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, I do think he had a very much an awareness of where the technology was going towards and where the thinking was going towards, which is also something that came to mind with me was, you know, that bit where you ask who's watching the watches?
Mm-hmm.
The answer, basically, like, how do you watch the watches, is from Socrates himself, where he says that one needs to fully train the soul. And this is quite important, because how do you fully train the soul? And it would also include being well-rounded within the various arts. The things that Socrates, and I know I'm jumping a little bit, I'm going towards Socrates at the moment, because we are facing today where, I mean, another phrase of saying who's watching the watchers is who's policing the police. So we are having shadow governments who are having havoc. They're doing what they want. And you kind of have to go, well, how do we even make people aware that there is a shadow government, you know? Socrates himself, he said it, you know, it's through musical and physical education. It's through exposure to poetry, through the art. So he was actually putting emphasis on, you know, gymnastics, the physical movement. He was putting emphasis on a lot of the things that are right brain focused. Another thing that he also said was that there should be a censorship of the corruption of souls, you know. And today we were actually discussing about Alan Watt also mentioned it, the trauma that is caused from being exposed to sex too soon as children. When children are exposed to sex education, you could say, but also within movies and films and so on, if it's too soon, they can have a trauma, and that the trauma reduces the cortical thickness and it impairs your growth in the brain. And it's exactly what Socrates had actually alluded to even back then. And another thing is, I mean, also to control one's desires. And we all know about those tests with the children to give them a sweetie. And then those who turned away and didn't take the sweetie actually showed that in life later on they fared much better. So to get back to William Blake and the senses, and also I think he was quite well aware of where they were heading towards. And the thing that really comes to mind for me is if we are looking at a generation down the line, maybe a few generations down the line, where everything is censored, if they have taken out the ability to even have these talks. I mean, we look at Adobe and Microsoft putting identity numbers on every single graphic that you make.
Mm-hmm.
So they will be able to track and trace every single graphic in the future. Because one would think, well, you know, you can do a graphic and just share that. It might not be the text that gets picked up and there won't be censorship, but even the graphics will be censored. So how do we then reach those who are seeking the truth? And I do think that is very important because it is directly related to knowing yourself. If you view yourself in the correct way, then you will also be able to relate to others and to the environment you are in, and space and depth, and your perception will be right. Yeah.
I don't want to take us too far afield here, but I've joked, and it's only a partial joke, that in the future, those of us who are conscious and aware are going to have to communicate only with our mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But and in order to reach that point, art and building your other senses is critical because
it
teaches you to think outside the little bitty box they've given us.
Exactly. And I think also the senses that Blake is referring to, the five senses, which is sight, hearing, touch, smell, because there are more senses than that. So I've looked them up and, you know, you have, I can't pronounce these names, proprioception, I don't know, it's a sense of position and movement, you know. If you look at choreographers like Pina Bausch, she's passed away, she was a German choreographer, fantastic with her influence on various artists. Wim Wenders made a movie of her, I think it's called Pina. And I actually went to see her shows, not with her in it. It was after she'd passed away. I think she passed away in 2009. And the Trans Theatre, which is the theatre group in Germany, continued with her work. And they had a show at Sadler Wells. A lot of her shows are still at Sadler Wells. And it's profound because it's a different language again. As you were saying, the language of movement, but it touches on the senses of position and of space, you know. We have the ability, if you and I are looking and we're opposite each other, we're looking at a box, the box will appear to be bigger on my side with the front ends and smaller on your side because of perspective, right?
Right.
Now, I have an ability and you have an ability to perceive depth. However, I cannot see what you see. Nay, because you are on that side. I think that, oh gosh, I've forgotten his name now. He was that guy that did the martial arts. He was in various films, it will come to me, but he, I think personally, as he was fighting, I can look him up in a bit, as he was fighting and doing martial arts, even though he was within various movies, I think he was from China, he basically had an ability with being blindfolded to fight an opponent and be able to defend himself without even seeing. Because I think he had the ability to use his sight that is not physical, if you get where I'm going towards. So that perception and that ability to see and depth and coming from a different perspective, we've kind of been boxed in with only focusing on the five senses. And these senses and learning about these senses have gone I've gone astray. So, I mean, other...
Was this other Bruce Lee?
Yes, Bruce Lee, thank you. Yeah. Other senses are a sense of balance and spatial orientation, which, again, you know, if you... Balance, I think, is, as we all know, your hearing has to be very good and very acute. And if you... I was thinking, actually, the other day of animals. A dog doesn't have good sight, but their sense of smell is very acute and very strong, stronger than, and they can smell more. So, yeah, I do want to mention just the other senses as well, but I don't want to go through these in depth. But you also have a sense of temperature, what is cold, what is hot. And someone was saying, well, not only what is cold, what is hot, but what is texture when we touch the cat. You know, it's pleasing, smooth texture or a rough texture. The sense of pain, the sense of time, you know, to be able to understand the passage of time. And also the internal state of the body, you know. I oftentimes ask myself, how are you doing, Andrea? How are things? You know, and then you kind of give attention to your body, because we are very easy at discarding what we are feeling. And we all know that being grounded in the body is also a way of regulating emotions, you know. So, yeah, of course, you also have the magnetic field. If you look at birds and fish, you know, being able to orientate yourself. I mean, if you look at, what's his name? Sheldrake. Is it Rupert Sheldrake? He did that experiment where he did a TED talk on it, actually. And I think that TED talk was banned. It was the first TED talk that they banned, which is very odd. But he did a lot of research.
Why did they ban the talk?
I think because it is actually touching on these on the senses, but more with regards to animals. So the communication between man and animal, he did research on, I think he did, and don't quote me on this, but he tested 500 subjects where when, say, with a dog, specifically with dogs, so say the owner comes home, then the dog is aware. The dog goes to the window and is just suddenly aware. I know my cat definitely, when I get home, the cat has already gone down the stairs. It's like, hey, have you been waiting here all this time? Mm-hmm. You know, so he did experiment.
Oh, go ahead. Tell me about the experiments.
He experimented by having owners come home at a different time using a different car. And monitoring the animals and realizing that there is a sixth sense, there's a communication between animals and humans. But it is obviously, it's kind of seen as woo-woo science.
Well, yet it does. I'm sorry, but embrace the woo.
Oh, do you? Okay.
You know, Alan told me lots of animal stories, but one that was fascinating and ties into this. He had a roommate many, many, many years ago, and that roommate was difficult and brought a lot of stress and tension with them. And Alan's dog at the time, not Hamish, but the dog would start to get tense and even sometimes agitated, and then 10 minutes later... or even 15 minutes later, home would come the roommate.
Oh, wow.
And he observed it over and over and over that his dog had an awareness of the incoming presence of this person.
Wow, that's interesting, hey?
Yeah,
I think there is something there. But I mean, I find personally with my cat, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and I think, I wonder where Sebastian is now. And then it's literally like a few minutes later and the cat will enter the room, you know. Yeah, I think also with regards to William Blake, there's a artist called Eduardo Paolozzi. He was born in 1924. He died in 2005. A Scotsman, even though he has an Italian name, he's Italian of descent. It's actually Sir Eduardo Paolozzi. And a lot of his artwork for me, I actually saw his exhibition at the Chapel Gallery, and it's not personally what I'd like, but it borders on hitting home the idea of man and the machine. So they're using art to bring in and ease in the concept of, hey, it's a natural evolution of merging humans with AI. He's also known for his mosaic at the Tottenham Court Road tube station. And he also did a sculpture from of Newton with his compass, which again it's after William Blake's image of Newton, also with a compass, of course. And yeah, I just want to actually read here with regards to Newton, because the thing is, William Blake did not like him at all. So it says here, he condemned the scientific trio of Isaac Newton, John Locke, and Francis Bacon as sterile and materialistic. Here Newton, the idea rather than a portrait, sits on a rock covered in algae, making calculations with a compass, like Urizen in Ancient of Days. He might be at the bottom of the sea or perhaps in a black hole. So I think art these days is being pushed for change in culture, of course, for influencing. I mean, nowadays you just get such ugly art, you know, and it's very demoralizing. One of the artists I do want to mention is Cleon Peterson. I'm not that familiar with him, but I find his work extremely depressing. When I look at it, it is so violent. Very recently, a mural of his work has been sponsored by, I'm not sure which Rothschild, but basically by a Rothschild, which is a mural that's under the Eiffel Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And he focuses on, he's got, I would actually deem him more an illustrator, but he focuses on black and white figures, and most of it has to do with racism. And if you look at, for example, it's so violent and it's so demoralizing, but it is a slaughter of the white figure. So you've got the black figures.
I'm looking at that right now. It's called To Create and Destroy.
Yes.
That's and a work in a way, from last year.
Yes. So, I mean, what he says of his own work, I'm just going to read some of it. It says, we've entered a new age of global crisis. It's exactly what Jacques Attali has also said. Modern dread, hopelessness, and existential anxiety have become common and relegated to the subconscious. And you know what? You almost get a sense that, I mean, I know that one could argue, but he's kind of the zeitgeist of the times. He's showing this is the feeling we are feeling, this is the situation we are in, and pointing to the issues that need to be addressed. But for me, it's almost promoting it, you know. He's almost supporting these ideas rather than criticizing these ideas. And he says, yeah, the individual walks the streets feeling a sense of alienation, and that society coopted by media, technology, politics, and an undercurrent of hate and confusion is unraveling. Yeah, because it is exactly that. It's going against the individual, isn't it?
Have you read, I think it's Francis Stoner, Saunders, CIA, and the Cultural Cold War?
No.
It's such a good book. She's a British writer. I'm not sure if she's a historian, but anyway, she's written a book about exposing the CIA involvement in the arts, in fiction, in theater, and fine art.
All right.
For the purpose of demoralization. Now, this is going back to the Cold War, but why would they exit that role, you know?
Yeah.
And now we... I mean, if I look at something like this Cleon Peterson, To Create and Destroy, obviously we are the audience of destruction or for demoralization.
Yeah. It is man against man, and then it's also it's a self-perpetual and a self-prophecy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at A Vision of the Future from 2019, I mean, 2019, we didn't have such massive racial... it feels to me like racism has increased, especially after 2020, especially because of immigration. It's come more to the fore. And if you look at this A Vision of the Future... Again, it's black and white fighting, and it's in a circle. It's very similar to M.C. Escher. He was a Dutch graphic artist. Yeah, he wasn't really acknowledged much, only at the end of his life. But he completely approached art from a mathematical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a similar, because when I look at that Visions of the Future, I'm thinking, oh, this looks like Escher. But he did various of these symmetric circles. So he would use truncated and stellar polyhedra. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, but he would basically use tessellations, and it's all mathematically worked out. So again, it's this Cleon Peterson, for me, is not only is it the work that and the subject matter, but it's also the way he's executed it, which is mathematical, which is again that ratio, the rationale, and again it's promoting the mathematic and an overemphasis on the when I say intellectual side, I mean it's the left side of the brain, moving away from organic shapes or from even texture, because all of his drawings or paintings are flat, they're 2D.
Mm-hmm.
There's no 3D modeling in it. And by the way, Greta Thunberg, who went on that boat trip, who was sponsored by the Rothschild, I think it was Edmund de Rothschild. That boat, also had the artwork of Peterson on it.
Mm.
So it's coming quite a while that they've been wanting to promote him.
Interesting.
It's basically the propaganda of today, in current day, I would say. But, so another thing I do want to mention is, because I was thinking a lot about Babylon, you know, the Tower of Babylon. And because we know that the word tower in Hebrew means pyramid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Peter Bruegel, I think he did three paintings of the Tower of Babel. I think only two exist. There's a larger one and a smaller one. But Peter Bruegel, the painting was done in 1563. I'm not exactly sure when he was born, but it was in the 16th century. And, of course, the Tower of Babel, it's being mimicked within the architecture of, I think it's the United Nations building. I can't remember exactly where it was now.
I think it's the EU building.
The EU
Brussels.
Building, thank you. Yes, there you go. If you look at that building, the same as with the painting, you'll notice that it's not complete. And I was wondering what is on the top, you know, and what is on the top is actually a temple, according to history, that it was, let me see, I think the temple was called Ezagil, I think is what it's called. And some say that it was just hypothesized, but others say no, it was, they found that it was an actual temple there. I was thinking a lot about those two pillars in front of the temple, you know, Boaz and Joachim.
Yes.
Especially from the writings of Jacatali in the book from the Losers and Winners from the Millennium, where he talks about having order, you know, so that order is established, or rules, or laws. I don't want to say laws, but basically order is established through, in the past it's been established through religion, which is, I don't know which one is which, if it's Joachim or Boaz, but the two pillars which represents military and religion, and that being how they maintained order. So, and Alan Watt also had a talk on this, on religion having such a profound influence on society. You know, the church, you'd give all your possessions to the church when you died, and the fear of being called a witch, you know, it was completely a rule by religion. The other pillar being military, which is by force. If you look at communism and the police having force on people, not submitting to authority, not being civil servants, but applying force. And those two pillars, when the temple gets destroyed, and I was wondering a lot about it, because Jacatali mentions a third manner of obtaining order, which is surveillance, right?
Mm.
So I was wondering if this temple, which will be brought down, and again, like, what was it that you were reading there with Cleon Peterson breaking down, building up, because it reminded me of the temple, and that perhaps the order that they want to bring in, obviously, will be surveillance, right? Which brought me back again to the other two pillars, because what came to mind was slavery. We all know that the slaves were chained to a concrete block, which is the blockchain. Within, I'm not sure exactly what you call it, but after 7 years, if you look at the book of Ruth, after 7 years, you'd have a reset, right? In Judaism, you'd have, so all the slaves would be freed. And however, unless the slave would choose to remain a slave, and that remaining a slave means they choose religion. You know, it's not by force. So it's the one pillar going into the other pillar. But if you look at surveillance, for me, I think it will encompass both ideologies, both religion and force. Although force, not a physical force, but within the electronic era. So you have your fridge, and your fridge is saying, oh, you've eaten too much, you know, because the United Nations will have something against people being too fat, you know, and they won't give money to certain countries who have too many fat people, for example. So that would be an enforcement, a militaristic order that's coming through the social credit score. If that makes sense, I don't know if what your views are on that. I don't know if you'd agree or not.
Well, it's interesting. I was just still thinking about the, you know, black and white and slavery. And, you know, if you get above people and just think of them as the checkerboard or the tesserated floor, you know, we're both being used.
Yes. And Actually, if you look at Victor Cousin, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. He also lived in the same time as Blake. He was like 35 years younger. And a French philosopher, also a politician. I'd gotten this book, which I have mentioned on the book club before, but it's a very odd book. It's got various discourses. And whilst I don't often read, but this particular chapter caught my eye, which is with regards to our inalienable rights. And this particular book has got, it's between the First and the Second World War, all the discourses, and they have a section on New World Order, and in that, they actually address why the League of Nations failed and how to, what would be the measures to overcome the failures of the League of Nations, which is where the United Nations were born. This chapter is one of these in here as well. He's had this chapter within this book with various discourses that was written between the First and the Second World War. He's written on one's inalienable rights. And I kind of want to mention a few things that he's said. But as I go through it, I don't want anyone to think of legalese speak, because he mentions person, the word person, but it's not in a legalese frame of mind. He's just referring to person. And a lot of what he says also refers to Plato's seeing people as it, you know, as objects. He says basically that the person cannot cease to belong to itself without degrading itself. Because a person in itself is inalienable. So if you look at an easy way I would see it is, we all have sovereignty, but we actually do not own sovereignty, just like we don't own our person. We can't give sovereignty away. We can't give our person away. And here he says, the person has no right over itself. It cannot treat itself as a thing, and it cannot tell itself, it cannot destroy itself, sell itself, sorry, and it cannot destroy itself. It cannot in any way abolish its free will and its liberty, which are its constituent elements. And this is very important, because why it is important, and I think why he was focusing on it, and a lot of what he also focuses on is using reason, and again, like within that materialistic scientific view, you know. But he does admit that the person is inviolable. Now, I'm going to just read here, and it alone is inviolable. It is inviolable not only in the intimate sanctuary of consciousness, but in all its legitimate manifestations, in its acts, in the product of its acts, even in the instruments that it makes its own by using them. And what stood out for me here is he's saying the sanctuary of consciousness. And one of the things that consciousness is the ability to know what is good and what is evil. So I'm thinking of myself when I was very young. I was about 8 or 9. I really liked this one gardener at school, and he was black. And growing up in apartheid, it was just horrible. Like, the headmistress, she would shout at him, and it bothered me tremendously. And I started to realize that it was wrong. And this was where I gained, I would say, consciousness, because I started to weigh up what is right and what is wrong. And with that, compared her actions towards him with the actions of my neighbors and the actions of some of my family and the actions of this and that and this and that person. And it felt like the world was wrong. And that perception and that reality made me more aware. And also what it does is it gives you a sense of metacognition. where you are questioning yourself and your own behavior with relation to what is good and what is evil, or what is right and what is wrong. Yeah, Kusin here, he acknowledges that, you know, that the person is inviolable in the intimate sanctuary of consciousness. But basically what he's getting at is that we cannot get rid of our person. Our rights are owned by the proprietor. In other words, just to come back to slavery, even if a person would say, okay, I give up my free will and I will be a slave, there is a wrong being done. You know, it is universally and fundamentally wrong. Which made me think a lot about transhumanism, because if you look at what Kusin is saying, is that it's actually alluding towards, we can't change the person, we can't change that they have sovereignty, and that it is an inalienable right, but perhaps we can change the nature of humans. In other words, letting humans leave their first estate and becoming transhuman, and in so doing, that this inalienable right will become annulled. Not sure if that makes sense to you, if what I'm saying makes sense to you.
Actually, what you've just described reminds me a little bit of Bernays, that you don't change the product, you change the market, you know, the people who are going to buy the product. So yeah. The product is, we're going into this metaverse, they want transhumans, so they go to work on us to change us, to get us to accept this vision.
And it's not only us, but in a way, it's changing the universal principles of who we are, because there is in us a part that has been made in God's image, and that part is the part where, for example, where we create, you know. Mm-hmm. AI can't, okay, they're trying very hard to sell to us that AI is creating, you know, but there's a thing where you can copy, and you can copy well, but then there's a thing where you can create. So William Blake and Tolkien, they created these worlds, and they created rules within these worlds, and characteristics, and conflict, and having catharsis. So the creations that they have made has been from imagination, which was, again, that opposite of what William Blake had, saying that we should balance reason with creation, and we should be fully trained, fully a fully wholesome soul. That part of us that have a bit of divinity in us, because unlike animals don't have consciousness, and they don't create. They don't feel bad for killing another animal. So this bit that we have, it's almost as if they want to move away, not only from the creational part of us, which is, I'm saying now, focusing on the right brain, which is about using the senses besides the five, in towards the rational reasoning, and in towards the metaverse and the electronic prison, basically.
Well, you've just taken us into what to me is the essence of Alan's work, and what I think about an awful lot. You know, he has said that humans have to be taught how to be human. We've lost so much of the natural modeling that we would get from our parents and our family, our tribe. So that's not there. So how do we learn that? And fully human is integrated with all of us. That's why that bit that you were reading there on the inalienable rights. See, when I read this at a glance without knowing the context of what he's putting across, what I'm seeing parallels the idea that you are forbidden to commit suicide. Now, that seems like a moral dictate that's a religious dictate. Well, it's wrong just because your religion says it is. But the person cannot cease to belong to itself if it's fully integrated. Integrated isn't even a good word. If it's fully aware of all components that make it fully human, it would not want to make that choice. Because awareness of the divine or the connection to divine is the key thing here. This is why Alan was talking about Julian Huxley saying we have to knock man off his pedestal as being an elevated, better, or somehow unique from other animals. Well, they know what they're going for there. That is our awareness that we are spirit as well as matter.
Yeah, exactly. And another word for awareness, and I really don't like the word, but it is consciousness.
Yes.
And this whole movement towards nature above man, or having equal rights for nature as well as for humans, is absolutely taboo. But if they can get us to believe that we are lower than nature, that we should bring nature above us, then we will submit our sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. But it goes beyond that, because I don't think they are just satisfied with the slave making a choice to be a slave, you know, with happy servitude. I don't think they are just happy with happy servitude, satisfied with happy servitude, because I think they want to change the very nature of human beings. Because if you look at what Schwab and Brim were talking about, let me just quickly go there, that conversation where Schwab was talking, Brim being the CEO of Google, mm-hmm. and saying, so basically being forever in a digital realm, right? Because he was saying, so Schwab was saying, can you imagine that in 10 years we are sitting here and we have an implant in our brains? And I can immediately feel, tell you how the people are reacting towards my answers. And Brim was saying, yes, you are going to be sort of transported into the internet forever in a digital realm. And you can imagine just in your biological incarnation, you live to be some very, very long age. So this is technology that's obviously existing, but we are not let in on it. And they are referring to what Alan Watt is often referred to as well, is the Borg, the B-Org, where, like in Star Trek, everyone can hear another's thoughts. Thing that comes to mind for me when I heard them talk about this was that in those days people will seek death, but they will not be able to find death, so they won't be able to die, right? They will long to die, but death will flee from them. This is the a verse from Revelation. So that's what came to mind. If they are able to incorporate or reincarnate our consciousness within the cloud, I mean, we know that they can then perhaps regenerate the body, you know, and that we won't be able to get free. I mean, it's not just a physical won't be able to get free, it's actually on a soul realm not be able to get free, that they change the complete construct and first estate of not only our mortal bodies, but our divinity, our godlike light. Actually don't like these words, but it's the only way I can explain what I'm trying to convey.
Look, this is this is challenging to talk about. If you and I are face to face or even just having a conversation for ourselves, then we can hear words that might cause a reaction and we can ignore them because we understand where the other person is coming from. Yeah. But this really is the essence of Alan to me, as far, you know, as far as I'm concerned, because where did he get his foothold in coming out to talk? It was on shortwave radio, and most of the early shows were Christian or Christian slash patriot. And what he said was amazing to them and yet threatening and terrifying and even like blasphemous. It was so unorthodox. And so he knew that, okay, that's his foothold, that's how he can talk. But if he says the word God, that comes with baggage. Mm. Creator is what he settled on. But everything, if you talk, I mean, he would say, well, you can't go wrong reading the New Testament. You know, just give people a clue. There's a lot of esoteric value there. But even that, people can't separate that from the baggage that they have about, well, I was raised in such and such a church, and I, you know, and how does Alan say that this is his astrological significance? You know, he died, there's the sun going down, he rises again on the third day, there's the sun coming up, it crosses the sky, there's the cross. How can he be saying this and tying it into pagan religions and still be talking about the divine?
It
is difficult for us because language was given to us. It's the same thing as like if somebody says they're a Christian, well, what does that even mean? What church do you belong to? Do they believe in a Trinity? Do they not believe in a Trinity? Do they believe Jesus was fully human and fully God, or Jesus was just a man? You see, it comes with baggage. This is impossible. Yeah. It's an impossible task. But there's a through line in Alan's work, and it certainly comes through in the books. To be human is to be fully human and more.
Yeah.
And it's that more that is essential.
Yeah,
if we're to survive where this is going, because this is not just cataclysm, boom, you're out unless your redoubt was just right.
Yeah.
This is a new world being prepared. Who is preparing it? Well, you know, we've probably opened a part two conversation.
Yeah, because, I mean, just also to mention that I've noticed that laws have been implemented during COVID, especially pertaining to your dead body. You know, in the UK, by default, you would be opted in to donate your body and your organs after your death, unless you have stated otherwise. Mm-hmm. And similar laws have been implemented in South Africa as well, where the state has declared they take ownership of your physical body. You know, things like if there's a pandemic, then they can take ownership of the dead bodies and might not give a burial, but rather
cremation,
yes. So, but obviously this, I think also Microsoft had patented that they could, I'll look it up and give you the link, but basically patented that you could, that they could have ownership of identifiers from this deceased in order to create a bot. So with, say your loved one's voice and your loved one's image, all these kind of things. So there's certainly been a move towards the DNA, owning the DNA even after death. Yeah, something that Darren also mentioned, because he posted an article on the fourth industrial revolution on the purpose of the metaverse. I just want to read a quote from there.
When did he post that?
This was on the South African group. I posted it in the book club, but I will post it again. It's actually quite important, but in it, so one of the quotes here is, the term metaverse was coined in Neal Stephenson's 1994 science fiction novel, Snow Crash, mm-hmm. where humans, as programmable avatars, interact with each other and software agents in a three-dimensional virtual space that uses the metaphor of the real world. Stephenson used the term to describe a virtual reality-based successor to the internet. I mean, WEF, if you look at them, they are having a section just with regards to metaverse, their futures, as they are focusing. One of their main focus is metaverse. Darren was saying basically that once this becomes wireless and it becomes embedded in human tissue, then it will seal humanity's fate, you know, because whilst one part of us is living in the cloud and playing a fantasy, a dream, another part will be hijacked, you know, kind of similar to when you're driving, you know, suddenly you're from in point A and then you're in point B. Mm-hmm. Your mind can kind of play tricks on you. And I think that is how Darren also described it. You won't have a sense of being a sentient individual in reality, you know. You'll be occupied in this virtual mind prison. And you won't be able to leave, you know. And that is what the metaverse is about. And you can see how, I think in the UK schools, they've now included metaverse time 4 hours a week. But they're taking away that creative side, you know, the arts. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's important to know, because metaverse will be a whole business and a whole enterprise in its own. You know, they will create cities within metaverse. It's going to be a whole economic industry. So people will want to go there because they're going to make money there, unfortunately. But yeah.
Did you hear a real history that I did last year with Judy?
No. No, sorry, I
didn't. I'll post a link to that one. A Judy in disguise with glasses. And she posited an interesting idea, and I believe there's truth to it. She's been reading Rudolf Steiner.
Oh.
And the idea of violating the human was something that he wrote about. And now what do we have? Believe it or not, there's this trans-able movement starting where people identify as missing limbs or being blind or not, you know, I just don't believe I was supposed to be born with arms.
Gosh.
And then she sent me some footage. It was a promo that was done for the metaverse, and it had little cartoon characters, and they were sort of floating around the metaverse with no legs.
No.
Yes.
But you know, this is all in preparation for merging with AI. And physically mm-hmm. merging with AI. I think Alan Watt mentioned about tattoos, that the tattoos were a precursor to the technology where the device is no longer on you, but it is in you.
Correct.
And, well, the thing also where they're going towards is towards creating Adam as he was in the Garden of Eden, where he was both male and female in one. Because from what I understand is they don't really want you to have children anymore, you know. I think Darren posted the other day an expert from H.G. Wells, I think it was. I'm not sure which book, but where the ability to basically fertilize the self and also doing it through vaccination is where they want to go to. So they'll have only a few select people who will be eligible to have children, and the rest will all be born from tubes, you know, and likely be born from tubes, but already integrated with AI.
Mm-hmm. And they won't need much of that either, you know. It will be a very different world.
And it's not really a case of, okay, I'm not going to take the vaccine, because they are spraying us. They are changing food, even vaccinating food, vaccination through food, and so on. But something that I was thinking of today, why is it that they want such a surveillance state? Especially thinking about, I went to a discourse at the Royal Academy of Science, and it was all about the unconscious mind. And the talk was, I think, it was Dr. Seth. And they were also talking about using brain scans and identifying if someone is a psychopath, and could one perhaps then do a brain scan at an airport, and if someone is approaching, you kind of arrest them even before they've done anything wrong. And it all sounds, yes, we want to catch the bad guy, you know. But what if it's the opposite, that they actually want to have this heavy surveillance to check that there isn't the odd person being born who hasn't succumbed to their methodology and their... I mean, Alan Watt was also saying that every so often, I can't remember exactly the quote, but that there are people who are aware. There are people who are, unlike what society has dictated, mm-hmm. have come through and are able to see and perceive without it being a realization. I know Darren is one. Darren has, from a very young age, had an awareness, whereas with me, I've only kind of, shall we say, woken up in recent years. But there are those that might have bypassed the system, so to speak. And perhaps the surveillance is to ensure that those people are not coming through the matrix, you know what I mean? They're not coming through. And what I was wondering was in terms of, would one have an intervention from God, you know? And I would say, I don't think there would be an intervention whilst we still have a choice. If, say, it comes to, this is my opinion, of course, if we come to a situation where we choose, say we choose life, I don't want to use that term because, again, it's bringing that history, but if we choose to not consent, then there's a gross injustice. And looking again at this Victor Kusin and how they want to play it by the rules. They kind of want to beat God at his own game, so to speak. And they want to change the construct of the universal principles. And so if there is that odd person coming through the ages, and they haven't caught them, they can then either influence others, or they could, even worse, regain sovereignty and choose. And when that is the situation, then it's almost as if, as being submitted to a higher authority, that they will lose the game, so to speak. Not sure if that makes sense, what I'm getting at.
I think I understand what you're saying. I've had similar thoughts, and I've had a lot of discussions with Alan about, because what you're talking about are things that ultimately will be out of our control. If they're putting this technology in the food, if it's being sprayed through the atmosphere, if thoughts can be beamed directly into our head, then what chance do we have? That's, you know, it's this is so bleak. But Alan's point of view is, first of all, the task is reuniting with the true Trinity.
Yeah.
This is difficult work because even people who might call themselves awake or conscious or I know exactly what's going on and how it plays out, I've read the script, might still think of this as a completely earth-contained scenario.
Yeah.
On this physical plane in your physical body. So it's a mammoth task of all of the indoctrination to even have this conversation, because let's face it, Andrea, the conversation might quite frankly sound crazy to many, many, many people. What?
Yeah.
Divine? Not trapped in this world? Who are they that want to trap us here? This is much more than eugenics.
Yeah.
And it's much more than the, you know, Brave New World or Fourth Industrial Revolution. So what is at stake is, you know, like I said, fully human and more. And at that point, when you are completely alive to that, let's say, you're profoundly changed, that is the point where I think
these are very hard concepts, and
yes.
Most people, having come through the pandemic, will give a logical reason as to what happened. Oh, it was pharmaceutical companies that were selfish. You know, they wanted to make money, and but
or
once
it's
you
depopulation.
Realize,
it, or they
it's
might even go that far.
Yes, but even to a point where you go, okay, and you start to realize the technology that exists. I mean, one of the questions I've had, which have not been answered, I don't have an answer, is why would they even keep humans alive? You know, what for? And I have asked Darren this, you know, if they can create humans from a tube, they don't even need a male or a female to create a human these days. Why would they even then entertain the idea of having half human, half AI? What is it that humans possess that they want to keep them alive for?
The soul.
Yes, yes. The godlike nature.
Yeah. We're shown this over and over in sci-fi. Aliens come down and experiment on humans, or some alien race, or some robotic future thing. It's always the soul. This is how it's depicted, but there's something there that's not there for entertainment's sake. This is what makes us different. You know, people, again, would try to pin Alan down on this. I put up a Redux recently where somebody was reading to him from his book, and they said, well, you describe this as unhuman, inhuman, something. You know, Alan said, well, you know, he wouldn't be pinned down in the conversation because he could tell off the bat the person calling had a certain religious indoctrination. They were coming from a certain point of view. So
yeah.
He played a bit of a word game with that person.
Yeah.
He said, well, let's just say what they're doing is inhumane. It's anti-human.
Anti-human,
who would be anti-human? You just have to ask yourself that question. Who would be anti-human?
Yes, and also it would be hard to believe that any human would be anti-human, you know.
I mean, some people with a materialist, fully looking for the fully rational, earthbound answer to this are going to say, Well, you know, Alan talked about Bertrand Russell saying they were, you know, eventually the elite and us proles down here at the bottom would have been bred and educated so differently as to become as two separate species.
Yes.
Or are well, we looking at something else? You know.
Yes, well, and that's what they see already. But, oh gosh, so much is going through my mind right now, but I'm having a bit of a clog. Yes. These are very hard concepts because they are of a spiritual nature. And whilst I don't like the word, it truly is what we are dealing with. You know, it is coming down to evil, pure evil. And thinking also what comes to mind is this mention that Alan Watt had. I was actually asking Frank about it in the group. In one of his talks, he mentions that, but it's so quick, hey? He was so fast. But he mentions, and I had to read the transcript, but that psychology and narcissism and psychopathy is being used to hide evil. It's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. All of these things that we are seeing today, I mean, there's been such an increase. If you go on YouTube, you just see psychopath videos or narcissist videos. If you go on Netflix, they are normalizing psychopathy. Mm-hmm. And but it's actually not psychopathy that they are normalizing. They are normalizing evil. Mm-hmm. What comes to mind is the UK Parliament not going for a ceasefire in Gaza. So they were doing exactly as they were told, basically. And you could go, yes, they're corrupt, whether they do it for money or, you know, whatever the case may be. They have, all those Parliament members have lost their moral compass. Mm-hmm. They are no longer, we are dealing with a much bigger issue here. If you have no qualm with killing 600,000 women and children in Iraq, you are actually, you've normalized evil for good. You've replaced evil for good or for what is normal. And your conscience and your compass for what is right and wrong is no longer functioning in the right way. So if they can get humans to no longer have that sense of what is right and wrong and replace evil for good. For example, in films, you will have, oh, you know, the quote-unquote protagonist killed all the good people, the innocent civilians, but that's okay because, you know, they won in the end, you know. So there's this smearing of the conscience. And in doing that, because from their stance, they see themselves as God. You know, the sense I get is that they want to recreate God. And I know that Alan Watt has often said, who will be the person who sits on the throne? I've thought about this quite a bit. And I wonder if it will be a person. I wonder if it won't be AI, the machine, or shall we say the oracle, you know.
That's interesting. That is absolutely feasible to me.
Yes, because I don't think, look, we're not dealing with nincompoops. These people are intelligent, and they know that they will consume each other, like the Titans. They have consumed each other. They know that they will do that. So in order to preserve, quote-unquote, their race, will they implement, shall we say, a buffer? Such as AI, in a way like the Kafka way. You know, the Kafka way is where you're constantly within a system, constantly automated, constantly not able to go, shall we say, in front of a king and mm-hmm. make a plea. Mm-hmm. No, it will be cold, calculated AI, no human, you know. And yeah, that, that
do you remember the movie with Tom Cruise that came out a few years ago? They were manning a station in the clouds and they flew these little drone type things.
I don't watch movies, so I don't really know. Yeah.
I think it was Oblivion. Well, it just reminds me, because this is something that is portrayed. Sally was the AI that ran these clones. Tom Cruise was one of them with his clone partner. And I remember when they were having a confrontation, she said in her robotic AI voice, "I am your God. I made you."
Mm.
And you see, there are other, well, I mean, in THX, what I always get the numbers wrong, 117848. They do confession to some kind of computer.
And also, I don't know who it was now. I've forgotten the name of the person. I will find it. But basically, he's the creator of AI. And he literally said, "We are creating God." I can't remember his name now. I'll find it for you.
Okay.
But yes, what comes to mind and why I think it as well is, if you look at the Tower of Babel, they were of one, what was it, language, right? And Bertrand Russell alluded to mathematics being the language that they want to instill. And that language is zeros and ones, which is binary. So the language of computers, you know, where if you look at the book People Shapers from Vanguard, where he speaks of only technology that existed up until 1976, he alludes to where it's going towards, where in the future schools won't be needed because you would basically download how to speak a language, or as Darren was mentioning in one of these stories, you, which is actually similar to The Matrix, where you go into, you're at a car crash and then suddenly you download how to be a doctor and you help someone. So that the language is binary. And if you look at the Tower of Babel, being of one language and being of one mind, right? Now, what is a mind? Obviously, it's that Borg, that B-Org. Because if you look at the Tower of Babel, it actually is a beehive. Mm-hmm. It looks like a beehive mm-hmm. to me. But what is on the top is the temple, right? And the temple is the brain, the AI computer, the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of why I was thinking, because usually God is in the temple, right? So what if they want to make AI as the Antichrist, as the God, you know, which is where nothing will be impossible, you know? Yeah.
Well, here is what can help that not be so overwhelming. We have that capability. Where did Jesus and his disciples go? To the upper room.
Oh, yes, of course. The upper room. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Hey.
So it's just, it's everything that evil does is a distorted mirror image of the divine.
Yeah, it's also, it's a mimicking.
A mimicking, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's pathetic. Well, I'll,
but it's,
go ahead.
Sorry. It's not only a mimicking, but they want to know the mind of God in order to become God. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and to play, the same as with Job, you know, like, okay, you can't do this to Job, you can't do that. Okay, can we break his spirit? Can we get him to fail? And then kind of, in a way, say, ha ha, God, we got you. You know, this creation, this righteous man is not really righteous, you know. But it's defying the principle, and in the end, it's defying God in order to become God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how I think that's the pride and the arrogance that they've got, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they want to change not only the human construct, but also change the location and the environment, I think, that we are in. Because one of the things that I've always, that's given me hope is, well, if you're in the dark, you light a candle, and that light shuns away the darkness, right? But never will you have a situation where you're in the day and you light a dark candle. You can't do that, right? Because from a universal principle point of view, that's not possible. And then what came to mind is they want to block out the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, oh my word, I mean, do they really want to play God to such an extreme where, like with the Tower of Babel, nothing will be impossible for them?
Well,
you know?
Alan would always say, it was a Sherlock Holmes quote, you know, when you've eliminated, well, I won't get it right, but when you've eliminated the impossible, you say, and what you're left with is the impossible, that's still what you're left with. Now, I probably slaughtered that.
Yeah.
You can't, however fantastical some of these things sound, you can't eliminate it. If you are willing to ask questions about what is this really? What is doing this to us? What is the nature of evil? I mean, I was listening to a podcast night before last, in a series on the nature of evil, and it's a philosopher. He was doing a lot of thought experiments. Can you separate evil from a harm or an action? Can you separate people from evil? You know, here is a person, he's done, so the thought game is, okay, he killed his two young boys and then he killed himself, but then you get this whole background of what had happened to him, or he's suffering from mental illness. By the time philosophers play these word games, you're left scratching your head, does evil really exist?
Hmm.
You know, what is it that we're really looking at? And I think that's part of the process of coming into being fully human. That's the starting point, is to develop the compassion, to be able, you know, someone wrote to me yesterday and asked, you know, they said that they know, they've listened to Alan for years, they understand the voting scam, but when it comes time to a big federal election, they still feel compelled to vote. And I wrote back a long email, but in part I said, so basically, how do they get around this, or how can they look at it differently? And I said, when you vote, you willingly participate in a system which is not just broken and corrupt, but has always been a sham. You are signaling that you don't mind being lied to, that you give your approval to deception, fraud, embargoes, and war, the deaths of millions of people worldwide, and on it goes. When you opt out, you're telling yourself, and that's the most important audience, that you are not willing to pretend the emperor is clothed. You are elevating your own worth to its proper place. This system was here when you were born, and it will likely still be here when you die. But you deserve more if you are willing to stand up for it, to say no, and to demand something different. Because what matters is the individual. If you adapt to this and say, oh, well, you know, go along to get along, you are giving active approval to psychopathic, narcissistic, at the least scum. And they don't think anything about starving, maiming, and killing millions, including you, who dutifully went to vote for them.
And also to add to that, it's part and parcel that pernicious hope, hoping that the Savior or Big Daddy will save me, mm-hmm. which is what, as mentioned before, Dante wrote on the gates of hell, like, relinquish all hope, you enter here.
Right.
Because if we relinquish hope, that pernicious hope, so it's an evil hope, right? If we relinquish that hope, then we actually can get to a point where we then take responsibility. So in this case, it's not taking responsibility or having actions for the environment we are in, but wanting Trump to fix it for you, you know, mm-hmm. or Big Daddy government to fix it for you, or socialism to give you money in the end for, you know, for the rest of your life, that UBI kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but pernicious hope is certainly a psychological weapon they've used against us, because they know how we are. That it is a good trait, actually, to have hope, but it's also a lack of maturity in a way.
Yes.
You know, not taking responsibility or passing the buck, so to speak, or refusing to accept the reality, because one would be hoping or holding on to a dream or a notion that is no longer feasible.
Well, I need to go take Aunt Betty to the doctor.
Yep.
But this has been a really delightful conversation, and you were hesitant that you wouldn't have anything to say, and
yeah.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been very nervous, especially in the beginning, you know, but it's okay. It's good. It was good. Thank you.
Well,
thank you so much.
I knew, based on our conversations and interactions, you've gotten me thinking in a different way, and maybe even a little more visually, which has helped, and asking more questions. So
yeah.
You've presented your understanding, how you see reality, has helped me. So I knew it would be an interesting conversation, for me at least. And
good.
I think others will relate to it as well.
Good. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate your input and your time as well. And never underestimate the work you do. It has a profound impact on people. It's changing people, not just how they think, but actually changing the being, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's very nice. Well, I think what we're scheduled for here on Real History next week is that John Euler is coming back, and we are talking about the transgender agenda. So,
good.
Yes. So thank you again, Andrea, and everyone have a good week, and I'll be back next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. And I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away.